You only have to look at Nick's Facebook page and list of friends, and that's probably half of them have got Muslim names, which says a lot. How did you get on such good terms with your Muslim neighbours in Stepney? What was the process?
I think it was just being willing to talk to people, but I think that the best thing I ever did was about 3 months after we arrived, I thought, I had a think about how could I connect a bit better. And one of the things I love is cricket, and Bangladeshi people love cricket too. And as it happened, there was a little cricket club that met very near where I lived, and they would do their net sessions behind a youth club. And so I plucked up the courage. I went along one evening with my bat. I'm not a great cricketer, but I do love cricket. And found myself in an environment where I was the only non-Bangladeshi, the only non-Muslim person playing. And I used to go every week. And so I got to know these guys really, really well. And what was fascinating was that many of them said to me, and I was slightly older than most of them, not exclusively, but they would say, actually, we don't really know many people like you. We'd love to, you know, we've always wondered this about sort of, you know, white Christian people. Could you tell me what you think about this or about that? And so they'd had maybe teachers at school, but they didn't generally spend a lot of time with people who looked like me. And I certainly didn't spend much time with people who looked like them. And so we had this amazing sort of cross-cultural moments between balls flying at my head at about 100 miles an hour, trying to duck out of the way. But we would have quite a lot of interesting discussions. And that opened up, well, then out of that got an invitation. It was during Ramadan to go to a mosque for a breaking the fast meal, an iftar meal they're called. And one of the cricketers said, look, we're having this meal, we wanted to invite a few people from the community to come along. And so I thought, I'll go along, why wouldn't I? So I remember going to the mosque that evening and sort of looking through the door, and I could see he'd said a few people from outside the sort of Muslim community were they going to be there, but actually I could see I would be the only one from, when I was looking through the windows. I thought, oh, you know, how's this going to go? But I thought, yeah, hold on, I'm, you know, this, what's the big deal here? So I went in, and it was probably about 150 people there, and we shared some food together. And it was a slightly different environment than I was used to. I had to take my shoes off, and we sort of sat on the floor and ate, and I used my hands to eat the very spicy food with. And there was lots of people speaking sort of Bengali, but actually people were so, so welcoming and friendly to me. But after that, I couldn't walk down the street without one of those people, because I stood out like a sore thumb. They knew exactly who I was. Coming over and shaking my hand and saying, hi Nick, how are you doing? And so that just became an incredible sort of bridge builder into the community.
And was Kerry similarly able to make contact with people?
Yes. So, I mean, mainly there were men at the mosque at that time when I went, but she often would take the kids. I mean, we both did, but she often went to kids with the parent toddler groups and things like that and take our children along. And we had so much in common with any parent, so that often she'd find herself talking to Bangladeshi women, and likewise, the school became a really important place for us to connect. So the school that our children ended up going to for primary school, they were one of very few non-Bangladeshi, non-Muslim kids in the school. So we were able to build up lots and lots of friendships amongst all sorts of different people, but particularly Bangladeshi Muslim people. And that for me was just, I have to admit, I absolutely loved that experience of crossing cultures. That was something actually I really enjoyed doing and learning.
And you worked on some projects with the leaders of the mosque, didn't you, in the community?
Yeah, so one of the things we often talked about was how we actually had lots in common beyond the fact that, you know, you could sort of look at us and we looked a bit different, and maybe we professed, said we had a different faith. But actually, when you get underneath that to this was, what we did share was the same neighbourhood, and we had the same problems in the neighbourhood, and there were lots of issues where we lived. I mean, it was Tower Hamlets at the time, sort of the highest child poverty in the UK. It was a challenging place to live, and One of the big issues we had was around drug use and drug dealing that was happening on our estate. And so it was just very normal. I mean, even my own son would be able to tell you from the age of about five, you know, who the drug dealers were, and he could sort of spot them. It was that sort of, you know, out in the open. And so we decided that we were going to work together to try and do something about that. And we organized a little campaign on the estate, essentially trying to tackle drug use. And then we also did a big festival to take over the park, which had become the sort of ground for all the drug dealing, that we said we were going to take over this park and make it a place of community. And we ran a huge festival. And that was, so that whole working together was just a brilliant way to get to know people. We realized we actually have so much in common, and lots of other people joined us from all right across the community.
But do you want these Muslim friends of yours to become Christians?
So, I mean, I love talking about Jesus with my Muslim friends, and they love talking to me about their faith too. And so it just became a very, what I discovered quite quickly was that actually, whereas in some parts of the community, it's actually quite difficult to talk about Jesus and about your faith, because maybe it's someone who doesn't have a faith, or as they get a bit embarrassed about, you know, we won't get onto religion. But actually, with Muslim people, they love talking about faith. And it's normally people like me who are sort of hiding away and not being so open. Actually, I learned very quickly that talking about what I believed was a good thing. And I've had some fantastic conversations with many, many Muslims over the years. I've learned a lot from Muslims, and I have seen some Muslim people who've decided to become Christians, and that has happened too. So for me, it was about, essentially, I don't convert anybody. What I do is I just talk about what my faith is, about what I believe in Jesus. If God chooses to reveal himself to somebody, then that for me is great. And if somebody discovers more about who Jesus is, then that's fantastic. And we did that, but that wasn't our sort of, you know, we didn't build relationships on that basis. We built relationships, and we just wanted to love people. And that for me was always the first and most important thing.
Go on, give us some tips then. So maybe I've got to, Muslim family moves in next door. How do we make friends? What can we do?
Well, I mean, I learned a bit of language is always useful. So it depends on which part of the world they're from. But every Muslim knows one phrase, which is Salaam Alaikum, which is just the greeting that Muslims greet each other with, which just means peace be with you. And so that's a good start. People love it when you can say a bit of their language. It's even better if you can find out what country they're from, what language they speak. And do that. The other thing is, food is quite good, but you obviously have to make sure it's halal. I mean, so one of the things we would say to our neighbours who are Muslims, we invited them around. We'd make sure we sort of say, we'd love you to come around, and spend some time with us, but we have some food with us, but we'll make sure it's halal. So it's understanding what halal food is, that you're not going to suddenly give them a glass of wine or give them some ham or some pork. You know, it's some sort of common sense stuff around food. But and hospitality is such a huge thing in many cultures of the world, whatever faith you are. But it's, I think, particularly strong for Muslims around times like during Ramadan, which we're actually in the moment, and that sort of after, that breaking the fast, that sort of festivity time. Sort of sharing food and that kind of thing is great. And just not being afraid to just approach people and just be yourself. I actually think that a lot of it is more that we're afraid that we do have to do particular things, when actually you just have to be yourself. And I think people love that. And just the fact you're willing to, like anybody else, go and just talk to them and treat them like anybody else. And that really is the main thing.
Great, thank you. Now you've moved on from Stepney, you're now at Raynes Park. You have the grand title as well of Salvation Army Refugee Coordinator, so really stemming out of what you've been doing already. How did you first get involved with these refugees and that work?
So for me, we'd spent some time with refugees and asylum seekers when we were in Stepney, we'd come across different people. But I think that in 2015, there was just something, obviously there was something significant happening in the world with refugees. And we'll all remember those images that were hitting the news, and particularly that image of that little boy, Alan Kurdi. That just broke my heart, really. I just saw that image and thought, how can I not do something? I mean, again, and maybe it comes back to this thing about social justice, and I just felt that that is unjust. It's unjust that people are dying in a boat in the Mediterranean because they just want to get to safety. And so I just felt we had to do something, and it took me, I didn't know what to do. I think, like most of us, we saw these images, we wanted to do something, we didn't know what. What could we do? Well, it took me to Calais, and I went to just see what was happening there, to the jungle. I spent 2 or 3 days there, met people, talked to people, tried to understand the situation. And I was absolutely, what I saw there was really shocking to me. It was 2 hours from our home. I remember coming back, it was late at night, but it's probably about midnight by the time I got home. And I'd spent the day in this camp where people, there were little kids on their own and young women on their own, and it was just it was full of mud, and because it was pouring down with rain, it was just no place for any human being to live. And you could see people sort of preying on sort of traffickers around. I remember getting into my lovely warm bed. I'd only come 2 hours. It wasn't like you crossed the other side of the world. This was 2 hours away, and sort of got into my bed, lovely warm bed. And it was, you know, I remember thinking, just being really angry that we have to do something about that. And so that led me down various things that I practically got involved with. But one of the big things was this idea of community sponsorship, which is where you can sponsor a refugee family and help them to come to the UK and resettle. In the UK, so this is through the Home Office program, where they were resettling Syrians, and our church got involved with that. And that for us was a very practical thing. You can't save everybody, but maybe we could do something for one family.
So what did you do? Tell us about it.
So this is the members of our church team along with the Syrian family, and so we. The program basically says that you need to raise a bit of money towards this project. You need to have a commitment for a year to be able to help a family that are brought over by the government. They come with refugee status, so they come with the ability to work and that kind of and be able to claim benefits. And we had to help them find accommodation that they could live in for 2 years, and they would get housing benefits towards paying for the rent. And we had to just help them with the very practical stuff of just, you know, how do you register at the doctors? How do you go to school? What do you need to, in British schools, do you need a uniform? How do we negotiate that? How do you get a bus and all of that kind of thing? So we built a team of people from the church who you saw in that photo, and we all had a different role. So there was, for example, in that image was a lady called Joan. Joan is the woman who knows every single bus route in Raynes Park. So if you want to get anywhere, you've got to go in to ask Joan. So she was a crucial member of our team because she could tell them that kind of thing, how to get an Oyster card, how you do all of that stuff. So we basically supported this family for, they've been with 2.5 years now living in Raynes Park. And it's just been this incredible moment. We went to meet them off the plane in Gatwick, and there was about 5 or 6 of us, and we had a sort of big welcome banner, and they sort of came through the gates, and they didn't speak any English at all, but they're amazing how quickly they've been able to pick it up. They're 3 children, and they all speak fluent English now. Mum and Dad are doing quite well. The Dad's working. I mean, it's just been an amazing experience of being able to support a family, but also I think the big thing about it has been, and everyone in that picture would tell you the same thing, which is, we thought we were doing something good for this family. Turned out it was us who've learned the most. We've actually had the best experience of all because we've learned so much from this family about so many different things, particularly about what hospitality actually means. Because we thought we knew what that meant. But it wasn't until we would go and visit them in those very early days. And every time we went around, they'd lay on food and tea and coffee. I put on some serious weight since they arrived, and some nice Syrian snacks. And they, you know, even during Ramadan when they were fasting, they would ply us with food. So, it was just fascinating for us to discover that in this sort of moment of hospitality that we were offering, actually, they were absolutely offering us just as much. And that really, yeah, that's some of the food that we were eating. And it's just been great. And as you can see, that, you know, that included some of the kids in our church with their kids. And so it was a whole range of ages got involved in this thing.
Brilliant. And there's a booklet about the experience, isn't it, that Home from Home. And Nick's got some copies. So if you would like a copy of this booklet, which is saying how to Raines Park got involved in this. Did it cost quite a lot of money to do this?
So there's certain criteria you have to fulfil, which the Home Office set down, and one of them is you have to raise £9,000. And out of that £9,000, then there are things that you will use that for. So that was used to buy school uniforms and give them an Oyster card when they arrived, that kind of thing. I don't think we spent the full £9,000 over the year, but that was the money that you sort of needed. Pot of money to draw on should you need it. You also have to be a charity to be able to do it. So there are various sort of criteria you have to fulfill.
How do you respond to people who say you shouldn't be encouraging these people and they ought to be going home? And you may not know, but there were some posters stuck up around sort of Fairfield Road on the High Street. Really complaining about Nick being here tonight and saying that Nick Coke is a race traitor because of the refugees. So some people really don't like refugees. What do you got to say to them?
Well, I mean, ultimately, we talk about loving our neighbour. And, I mean, that's what I subscribe to as a Christian. Before I'm anything else, if I love my neighbour, well, who is my neighbour? My neighbour is not just the person who lives next door. How would Alan Kurdi and his family not be my neighbour in that sense? So I think that we particularly those of us in wealthier countries, and we're definitely one of the wealthiest countries in the world, I think we've got the sixth biggest economy in the world, how could we stand by and do nothing while people are dying? And we've all seen the image of the conflict in Syria, the displacement of people. The countries next to Syria, like Lebanon or Jordan, have millions of refugees. In Turkey, they have millions of refugees. And I mean, a third of the population of Lebanon are refugees. That's how many. So for us in the UK to take 20,000, which was the pledge that the British government made, sounds quite paltry, to be honest, to me. But it's something. And I think that's We just have our duty to play. And we certainly, you know, we would hold up British values, wouldn't we? And in the past, we've certainly welcomed refugees, whether that was the kinder transport, at other times of need. And I think it's actually part and parcel of who we are. As British values, if we want to use those words, well, let's live up to them. If we say we've got them, let's live up to them. And part of that is helping people at an absolute time of need. And when you just see that what's happened, particularly in Syria, how could we not help is probably my answer. How could we do nothing?
Thank you. But you're not ceaselessly campaigning, I know that, and you have a great love for music. And when we came around to see you the other day, you told me that you had approximately 632 albums. Has that number gone up since I last?
It's funny enough, it has. So I'm about 634 vinyl records, because that's my passion.
When do you listen to these? When do you have time to listen?
Well, I quite like listening sort of before I go to bed. So I like the kind of those later hours when you sort of finish the day's work and you've got a bit of sort of relaxing.
So you just
time.
Put the headphones on. You don't inflict it on other people.
No, I do inflict it on. My wife, she just goes upstairs, and trying to convince my son to sort of get into the same kind of thing. So he started to appreciate some of my musical tastes.
Yeah. So who are the stars in your collection?
Well, I mean, I have three particular favourites who I call my sort of holy trinity of singer-songwriters. So my ultimate favourite is Bob Dylan. But I also love Leonard Cohen, and I love Nick Cave. And so these are three of my sort of favourites. So I have pretty much every Bob Dylan album on vinyl, which is quite a lot if you know how many he's actually made.
Now, you talk about sort of Nick Cave. I think that probably one of the most beautiful love songs of the 21st century is by him, and it has definitely the most original first line. And I think we're going to hear it and see it now, with any luck. No.
To intervene when it came to you, well, not to touch a hair in your head, leave you as you are. If he felt he had to direct you, then direct you into my arms, into my arms. Into my arms, oh Lord, into my arms, oh Lord, into my arms.
So that first line, if you didn't catch it, was, I don't believe in an interventionist God. Not the sort of lyrics you normally get in a song, but do you believe in an interventionist God? I had to play that clip just so I could ask that question, really.
That was a great clip. And how can you not love a song with a line like that in it? Of course I believe in an interventionist God. And I believe God is doing all sorts of things in the world, some of which we notice and some we don't notice, and some through us and some despite us. So I'm pretty convinced that God's sort of got it covered, and he knows what he's doing. And I've experienced God, and I've seen God at work in different
ways. Yeah, so how has he intervened in your life?
I mean, so for me, you know, a lot of what I believe God has done in my life is not the big dramatic stuff. It's not sort of, you know, those what we think of as Paul on the road to Damascus moments, these big sort of bright shining light stuff. It's often the gentle, everyday things that I think God is doing in us and around us all the time. And I can look back on my life and I can think of particular times when I know that God was close, when God really spoke to me, when God touched my life because somebody else was there. And I think back of all those people in my life who have been so foundational to me and my own growth as a Christian. I think of my Sunday school teachers, I think of my own parents, and those who God has worked through to touch my life. And I think he's doing it all the time. I mean, amazingly, I mean, just a little example of how God does it in the small things sometimes is that I had my hair cut 2 days ago. You might not have noticed, but I did.
Very impressive.
And yes, and as I was sitting in the barber's chair, the barber asked me, well, what are you doing at the weekend? And I said, well, you know, on Sunday I'm quite busy because I'm a church leader. And we got into this amazing conversation about the fact that he told me his story, and he's an Iranian who came here in 2012 and became a Christian. And he goes to a church in Chiswick where there are 500 Iranians. And he's told me about how there's this movement of God amongst Iranian people and how many, many people are coming to faith. And it was interesting because I, as you said, I'm the refugee response coordinator of the Salvation Army. And I often get questions from Salvation Army leaders around the country saying to me, we've got Iranians coming, suddenly turning up at our churches. Can you tell me where to get resources from? My barber told me where to get the resources from. And because he says they're published in his church because it's the center of the Iranian movement in the UK. And I thought, you know, that's amazing. That's amazing. And, you know, you can't orchestrate that. But God, that's what I think God does. He surprises us, and he does it in ways that are sometimes unexpected. And sometimes we have to kind of look for him too, that it's just not always totally obvious. But yes, an interventionist God, absolutely.
Nick, we've run out of time. Thank you very much indeed. We've really enjoyed having you here.
Thank you very much. Thanks.